Hello and welcome to episode number 13 of D 50 Shades of D&D. Lucky 13, as we're hoping. And with me now are my co-hosts, James.
Hey, everybody.
And Rick.
What's up?
And on today's episode, we're going to do things a little bit differently. Normally, we play a game and we review that game, but today we like to call it our multi-classing episode because we're going to cover three different games that we may or may not have played, but each one of us is going to, we've chosen one that we're going to present to the others and talk about it a little bit and see how it goes. So I think we're going to start off with Rick.
Yeah, I wanted to say first that I say we don't call this our 13th episode. I say we do like the hotels do and just say this is our 14th episode. We all know it's the 13th episode, but just to make everybody feel better about it, we'll call it our 14th episode.
So if you count episode zero, this is our 14th episode.
See, there you go.
So
that'll confuse people when they're like trying to down, you know, which did I, where's the 13th one? I mean, I see 12, I see 14.
Maybe I'll run that by corporate and see if I can post it that way.
Yeah. Ask for Hank.
Hank.
He's got a good sense of humor.
Okay. So what game do you have for us today, Rick?
Today I picked out an old favorite. It's called Mazes and Minotaurs. And what's going to be a recurring theme through our choices today, one of the top benefits of Mazes and Minotaurs is it's absolutely free. We will, I guess, Todd, will we put like the link in the show notes or something like that? We'll post it on social media and so forth, because I don't really have it. And it's always awkward when you're trying to spell out a link. But I'm sure if you Google in the meantime, Mazes and Minotaurs, it'll come right up. It's by Legendary Game Studio. It's based on an original idea by a gentleman named Paul Elliott. And then the game design itself was a Frenchman. His name is Olivier Legrand. What happens was Mr. Elliott, Paul Elliott, wrote an article for RPGNet that was kind of like a satire. And it proposed an interesting idea. What if instead of being inspired by Appendix N and Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, Robert E. Howard and Fritz Lieber and so forth, what if instead of being inspired by those sources, both Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson instead had been inspired by the works of like Ray Harryhausen or like Homer.
Edith Hamilton.
Yeah, Greek mythology. Yeah. So now that is not to say that they weren't. It's pretty well known that Gygax loved that kind of thing, but it was secondary. Well, this article proposed, what if it had been the primary thing? So not only is, I'm getting ahead of myself. So he writes this article. He refers to the game like it was really done, like it was really created it back in 1972 and then was revamped with the second edition in 1987. So the article is a big hit. And this guy, Olivier Legrand, he reads it several times and then decides to himself, like, wouldn't it be cool if somebody actually made this game that Paul Elliott just refers to in the most general terms? So he gave himself like a couple of design goals. He wanted to write it in English, which is not his first language. He wanted to write it with a genuine old school 1970s feel. And then he wanted to write a game that would be totally coherent with what Paul had said in his article. But at the same time, he wanted to make sure that the mechanics really held up so that it was not a mess of mixed ideas, but rather that it had some cohesion to it. So in that sense, maybe that counteracts the genuine old school 1970s feel again, but whatever he did, I think he succeeded wildly because I love this little game and I always have.
So let me get this right. It is actually a real game with the back history of a fake game.
It is not only available in the 1987 version, the second edition,
which was also really written in the 2000s.
Exactly. But it's also available in the 1972 version, which is more like, it's more synonymous with, say, like the little brown books or the little white books, the white box.
Okay, so it has a fake history, but it is actually a real game. So Mazes and Minotaurs is like the Spinal Tap of role-playing games.
It is like that.
I would say it's kind of the Edgar Rice Burroughs of role-playing games, because that is like a staple of Burroughs is John Carter, right? Like this fake history that is, years later shown, like when they find John Carter's
journals.
Yeah, journals, right? Like,
this
is like that for a role-playing game. And I love the spirit of that.
I love that, because that brings it back to like D&D Appendix N. But my own analogy was more, I was going for a Princess Bride feel, in the sense that William Goldman wrote a book called The Princess Bride, and he credited it to an S. Morgenstern. And from my days in the bookstore, I can tell you many, many people never got the fact that that was not correct, that Goldman created Morgenstern himself, that Morgenstern was not an actual real guy. And, that Goldman did not discover that book and publish it for him. But anyway, we're getting off track. So back to the game that I chose, Mazes and Minotaurs. So again, a lot like old school D&D, but uses Greek mythology as its impetus, rather than Tolkien style trolls and orcs and elves and dwarves and so forth. I mentioned the 1972 version, but I'm going to concentrate today on the quote 1987 unquote revised edition, which most resembles, in my mind, AD&D second edition. Like, for example, the way the classes are all organized, where there are warriors, and then each one of those warriors is divided up into, like, there's spearmen, and there's barbarians, and there's Amazons, much like the way that AD&D 2E took they did the same thing with the way they lumped paladins and rangers and fighters all under that one category. So I touched upon classes a little bit. The classes include, like I said, there's spearmen. That's the basic fighting man class. There's nobles, there's centaurs. So there is race as class. You have both centaurs and nymphs available. Those are all lumped under warriors. Then under magicians, you have elementalists, lyrists, kind of like a bard, I guess, the aforementioned nymphs, priests, which are probably closest to your clerics, and then finally sorcerers. And finally, specialists include hunters and thieves. So it's a, that basically warrior, wizard, rogue dichotomy. Each of the classes can go up to a maximum of level 6. So even before, there was that E6 business about that sweet spot, that D&D sweet spot basically pats off at level 6. This was ahead of the game on that. Your characters they have different, it's not just simply XP that they gain their levels by. Warriors gain glory points. Magicians gain wisdom points. And then finally, there is experience points, but that's simply for the specialist. And then it breaks down by, like, warriors get it for, like, slaying monsters and accomplishing heroic deeds. Nice. Wisdom points are gained by defeating supernatural foes or exploring unknown lands, that sort of thing. And then finally, experience is gained differently for each specialist class. Hunters gain it by slaying and capturing beasts. And then while thieves gain it by, as you might imagine, acquiring loot and valuable items. Really like the way saving rules work in this game, in that it's not only, a saving rule, but it's also basically your skills all work off of saving rules as well. You have athletic prowess, danger evasion, mystic fortitude, and physical vigor. And then in the game, if you want to do something like a perception roll, well, that's your danger evasion roll. And almost all saves in the game have a target number of 15. So you roll you would add like there's a score called luck in this, which is really kind of like an Uber score in the sense that all characters, when they level up, they gain a point in luck. Luck adds to almost everything in the game, from like your ability to hit melee to your armor class, which is called defense class in this. It's all dependent on luck. And so rather than have like, you know, the to hit chart like AD&D had, you just every level, you get another point in luck that adds to those scores. And so therefore, as you level up, you get better and, you know, you're able to hit better. You're able to your armor class gets better yourself. It's all dependent on that luck score.
Interesting.
It's not really like the luck in DCC. You don't like, you know, spend it, that sort of thing.
Is there, with the, you know, ancient Greek mythology kind of theme and vibe, is there anything like the three fates, kind of like does fate play a role in luck or anything like that? Or
that probably so. And of course, after we finish recording, I'll probably think of something or come across something that resembles that. There is a lot of stuff. The gods are very active in this game. So unlike other games where meeting or encountering or speaking with one of the deities might be extremely rare, it's pretty common. This, as a matter of fact, in one of the adventures, the many adventures that they provided for this game, you meet, I think it's almost said Mercury, but I got to remember, this is Greek. So you meet Hermes very early on, and he provides you with some much needed information, a couple of magic items to get you started, you know, not unlike Clash of the Titans when Perseus provided with all those cool items at the very beginning of the film before he's done a single thing. He's got like the magic sword, the helmet, the shield, all that jazz. It's all sort of provided for him. So you could probably expect the same thing, because after all, you've only got six levels. So, you know, you got to get busy. And speaking of six levels, a first level character in this is pretty competent. The example character, which is a spearman, has a defense class, which is pretty much equivalent to AC of 21.
Wow.
Number one, because
Characters aren't,
they're not as heavily armored as in say D&D. You know, plate mail is unheard of. The most you're going to have is like a breastplate, a shield, and maybe a helmet. So instead of starting off at a base, they start you off at a base of 12. So everybody gets to start off at a base of 12, and then from that, I think for every piece of armor that a character wears, and again they mention the breastplate, the helmet, the shield, that adds plus two. And then spearmen, if they're fighting with the spear, they get to add, I think, their skill bonus. Skill is equivalent to, say, dexterity in D&D. They get to add that to their EDC, their effective defense class. So, yeah, he's finally got a final score of 21, which is really impressive and shows you that where it might only have the six levels, you know, you're able to get right into it from the very beginning. This is and your ability scores are rolled with 2d6 plus 6. So
because you're heroes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because you are heroes.
So yeah, you're immediately playing like a young Hercules in the middle of like his first few labors, right? Of the 12 labors or Achilles or. Yeah, that's cool.
So nobody should feel like a, you know, often in old school or OSR D&D, you know, you can have those roles that leave you with that, you know, lovable loser. But these are heroes. These are heroes from the beginning. Even your magic using classes might have some pretty impressive scores simply because they, too, are rolling 2d6 plus 6 for those scores.
I was probably about 10 years old when the Hobbit cartoon came out. And leading up to that, movies like Jason and the Argonauts or Hercules movies, books on mythology, I would sit down. We had a set of world book encyclopedias, and I would pour through the mythology. So I could find a lot of information on Greek, Roman, and Norse mythology. But in those days, that was about it. So until I saw the Hobbit cartoon, Greek mythology was huge for me.
It was my gateway to just about everything else that I enjoy. It was kind of my gateway to comics. It was my gateway to RPGs. So I remember, you know, I've told the story before of like seeing the first edition Monster Manual on the guy that my first day of high school. This is like 1979. The guy next to me has the first edition Monster Manual, and I recognize the, the mythological creatures on that. And so that's what I thought it was. I thought it was like a book of like a mythology book. So when I figured out it was a game, that blew my little mind. And you know, haven't you know been hooked ever since. But I've got a couple more just random, I guess, notes that I wanted to make about the game that I picked. Obviously, I think you can tell I like it. I like it a lot. There's some real innovations here, considering it comes from like 2005, 2006. It's the first example of what we now know as advantage, as an advantage disadvantage from 5e. It's the first example that I could find. And I've done a little bit of research. Somebody might be able to prove me wrong, but I've gone to some pretty, authoritarians in the field and see if they could correct me or point me in any other direction. And so far they have not. So there's all the warriors and specialists characters are assumed to be proficient with all weapons, but they also have what they call a weapon of choice. And with that, they are especially skilled. Anytime they make an attack using their weapon of choice, and stop me if this sounds familiar, the player simply rolls 2d20s separately and keeps the better result, applying the usual modifiers to this roll. So it does not have disadvantage. But that sounds to me, that's like 5e advantage right there.
Yeah.
I remember you bringing this up in a chat, and I'm sure all of us spent way too much time Googling to try to either verify or to debunk that.
There was a 3.5 book called Path of Battle, I believe, that came out in 2006.
Yep.
And it had a particular, you know, one of those classes that had like a shadow blade or something like that. It had that mechanic where you got to roll the 2d20s and keep the better, but it was, again, for a very specific subclass within another class. And also it kind of meant a different thing in the sense that I think what it meant was the character would swing their blade and a phantom blade would be included, which would throw the foe off. And by rolling the 2d20s, you did get to keep the better one, but it wasn't exactly representing the same thing that advantage does. And I think that this weapon of choice, I think it's, you use your weapon of choice, in a sense, you have an advantage. And that mechanic, that was the first time that I've ever been able to find it.
That's really cool. I'm sure someone is hearing this episode right now and going, someone's wrong on the internet, and will correct us.
I welcome it. I would love for somebody else to point out, like, this was the earliest result I could. I wanted to talk about a couple more things. This also, speaking of 5e, this thing had death saves. When you were reduced to like zero hit points, you had to make a save, and you added your physical vigor modifier to that. If the result was less than 10, the character died. So no three save, one save, you know.
Wow.
Get reduced to zero or less, fail that save, and your character is dead.
That's awesome.
And that predates DCC's Rolling the Body by like five years, right?
Happened by a couple years. Yeah, they did. The spells are cast with power points. It wasn't like a Vancian Fire and Forget. It used power points. Of course, I did the research and I found out like there's no true magic missile in the game, but I did find something that, two spells that you tell me if these sound familiar. All right, first, elementalists that study like the fire spells can cast a spell called Dart of Fire. With this power, an elementalist summons forth a bolt of pure fire to hurl at his enemies. This fiery attack requires no attack roll, but may be dodged with a danger evasion saving roll. The dart does 1d6 damage. All weapons in this game do 1d6. with few exceptions. I think daggers do 1d3 unless they are used like in a backstab type situation, and then they do their full 1d6. But anyway, the dart does 1d6 damage and has a range of your mastery times 10. The range is doubled for elementalists with fire as their primary element. The one other spell that resembled it is under sorcerers have a spell called Psychic Attack. With this power, a sorcerer may strike his foes with an invisible bolt of pure sorcerous energy. And other than that, it works almost exactly like Dart of Fire, just reskinned as a psychic attack.
Nice.
I had one other thing I wanted to mention real quick, if I have time. Todd, you tell me if I'm running.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
The way they treated encumbrance. A lot of those skills that I mentioned earlier, like be it climbing, swimming, stealth. Like I said earlier, most saves required a save versus like a blanket score of a 15. But in the sense of if you attempted anything like that, stealth, climbing, swimming, you had to, your target number was your encumbrance number. So most humans would start with a base of 10. And then they would add like one or two points for like a sword is one encumbrance point, a spear is two, that sort of thing. The example character that I mentioned before, the spearman, had a final encumbrance of 19. Now he was fine because he had a high strength and you're not doubly encumbered until your encumbrance is total to your twice your might score. But if he was to try like to move stealthily or to climb or to swim, without like setting some of that stuff down or taking off his armor, his save would be a score of 19 because that's his encumbrance. I thought that was a really cool, really clever way to do it. Normally, I don't get real excited about encumbrance. It's just not one mechanic in games, be it old school or otherwise, that I really like. You know, I usually sort of gloss over it, but I did like the way they used that.
Yeah, usually we start looking at encumbrance when you're looking over the player's shoulder gone, and where are you keeping all of this stuff? And then you have to break out the rule book.
Yeah.
So to sum up, mazes and minotaurs, not mazes and monsters, like I've been like dreading, like, please don't say that. Please don't say that. So, mazes and minotaurs.
Tom Hanks' agent is typing up a memo to us right now.
Yeah, I thought so. But easily available on Google. You should check out both versions, but I really encourage like the faux, the 1987 version. That's the one that these rules and so forth I've been quoting from that. It includes both the main rule book, and then there is an equivalent of the DMG, the Maze Master's Guide. There's a monsters book that's just chock full of monsters, all the Greek flavored monsters, and some that are from classic Greek mythology, some that you will recognize from much more modern sources, like there's Calibos from Clash of the Titans, and I think there's even a little robot owl that should be familiar to anyone that's seen that film. there's a companion, which is kind of like, I guess, their answer to the Unearthed Arcana. It's a great game. You should check it out. And if you want to play, text me, get a hold of me. I'd love to be a part of that.
So the artwork, you know, I looked through them too, Rick. The artwork is pretty nice and fitting the mood of the game.
Yeah.
The interior pages are for the most part black and white, but the covers are all in color. And there are some really nice pieces in there. And it does have that kind of OSR feel. But, you know, again, all with a Greek mythology theme to it.
So because I feel like listeners of the show will feel like I have to say something. The layout is 2-column. It's pretty nice. And, of course, it's Times New Roman, which,
ha.
I love the idea of like taking it back to like Greek myth because like some of the early things they talked about I remember in the G+ days in like the early days of the OSR or whatever was talking about like this idea of a mythic underworld and how, you know, dungeons behave with in a mythic underworld versus like a realism kind of strategic simulation. And this is great because it's like literally the mythic underworld. Like,
the continent or the campaign world is called Mythica.
Nice. Yeah.
Oh, you know what? I got through all that and I didn't even really mention the core mechanic, but I guess everybody should assume by now that if we're talking about a game, it's pretty much the same as D&D. It's roll a d20, add modifiers. You're going for like in this case, if you're trying to strike an enemy, it's going to be their defense class or their effective defense class. Like I said, many other like non-combat tasks sort of use a universal target of 15, but there's special cases, of course.
So we'll move on to my selection for the day, which is Iron Falcon, written by Chris Gonerman. If you recognize that name, it might be because he put out the Basic Fantasy role-playing game in 2006, which was actually considered one of the first retro clones, in which he used the Open Gaming license to emulate Moldvay Cook. But he did have Ascending Armor class and some other more modern features. So I think
was that, that was as an option, right? Or was that?
No, it just says the Ascending Armor class in it. Okay. It doesn't do like OSE and put both. And it's basically a Moldvay Cook basic. And I think after getting some criticism that it was not a true retro clone, he came out with the Iron Falcon game, which is much more of a direct copy of what would be White Box D&D plus the Greyhawk supplement. So there's the addition of like the thief class. There's variable weapon damage and something a little more recognizable as D&D than the original White Box can be at times. And so I need to tell you how I came across this. Even though it's my pick, Rick is the one that told me about it, because I was looking to run. So I have the Judges Guild Dave Arneson's first fantasy campaign, and I'd been wanting to run some classic Arnesonian adventures.
So wait a second. So you chose a version of D&D that just had the Greyhawk supplement?
Yes, because the Blackmoor supplement really had almost nothing to do with Dave Arneson, as far as I can tell, except for the Temple of the Frog adventure, which we may get to. We'll see. But, you know, I was telling Rick about it, and I said, I want to use the original White Box D&D, but I want to use the Greyhawk supplement, because I like the additions from it. I like the addition, the variable hit points for the classes and the new classes that are available. I do believe that is also includes the paladin, but I'm not sure if the paladin is in here.
So no monk, no assassin.
Correct. So, and I've actually been running a campaign, the first fantasy campaign with this for the last several months. And it's great because I don't have to sit there with $1,000 worth of books on the table. And just like Mazes and Minotaurs, it's free. You can download it. And there's a updated version that I don't think I've downloaded yet. I think this is like, it said like version 52, or I'm not sure what that means. But it's basically as classic a D&D as you can get. It says dedicated to Gary, without whom none of this would exist. First edition, release 52. So I'm not exactly sure what release 52 means.
I think they've revised it that many times.
That could be. You know, so it has the recognizable, the magic user has D4 hit points per level. The fighter has D8 hit points per level. The thief, well, has the original D4 hit points per level. There are dwarves, there are halflings, there are half elves. It does not have races class, as a lot of people incorrectly state that original D&D was races class.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, it has the variable weapon damage. It has damage versus man-sized and damage versus large creatures actually separated out. So I think the Greyhawk supplement would have been the first book that actually did that, as far as I know. I'm sure if I'm wrong, the internet will tell us. Something I do like is the attack matrix. And some of the charts are laid out a little better than in the original. Well, a lot of things are laid out better than the original D&D books, because had to cut them out and actually physically cut and paste things to move them.
Yeah. Would you consider like Gonerman, Chris Gonerman, the author? Is he kind of like a modern day J.R. Combs?
Yeah. So in a way, he what he did would be a similar project to what J.R. Combs did.
Right.
But he actually stayed probably a little more true to the source material and kind of sorted it out. And it makes more sense to, you know, your typical gamer than someone reading those original little books, which can be a daunting task at times.
And setting aside presentation, because, you know, OSC is going to win that hands down every single time. But right. As far as communicating the ideas, communicating the rules in a way that's logical and makes sense and doesn't overwhelm somebody, who would you give the upper hand to? Would you give it to Gonerman, or would you give it to, what's his name, Gavin?
Norman, yeah.
Gavin Norman of OSC.
So OSC is more along the lines of what basic fantasy is and not sure. Iron Falcon.
Yeah, sure.
So Iron Falcon is kind of...
It's two apples and oranges?
Or? Yeah, it's two... Original D&D, what OSE is to Moldvay Cook D&D.
Right.
Basic fantasy is just as sound as OSE. It's not as gorgeous, but it's also free, right? You can, I think you can download that for free as well. If not, you can find it pretty inexpensively all over the internet. So another thing I like about Iron Falcon that you don't get in classic D&D books is all the spells are arranged alphabetically. So you don't have to remember if it's a third level cleric spell or a fifth level magic user spell before you look it up.
The folks at home can't hear me, but I am clapping. That's fantastic.
And I've got mixed thoughts on that. I see the benefit of that, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just so used to it the other way around, where they're listed by level. Well, divided up, of course, by whether they're cleric and magic user, and then divided by level. But I don't know. I'm mixed
up. So here's how I feel about that. If you're sitting at a table full of experienced gamers, and each one of them has their player's handbook, and they know what their class can do, and they know what their spells are.
Yep.
Putting the spells by class and level is perfectly fine. Sometimes guys like us that play 50 different versions of D&D, you know what the name of the spell is.
I don't know about playing them, but I sure own them.
right. And
yeah.
But
yeah, I see your point, and I was about to say, wow, if that table exists, maybe I'll get to play at that table one day, because I certainly don't play at it right now.
Right.
love you, Zach.
So the artwork, I guess if there's a complaint about this book, the artwork is very sparse, but I really like the artwork that is there, and the cover is a pretty snazzy old school look to it.
Yeah.
And like I said, it's a free download.
Does he ever attribute like where the name came from? It's a catchy name.
Well, I guess an Iron Falcon would look a little bit like a gray hawk, right? Is what I'm
all
guessing.
Right. All right. I see what you're doing.
He's done significant work in what we would call the OSR, but he's a very low profile guy from what I can tell. You know, you don't hear him mentioned in general conversations. And I think he should get...
Yeah, he deserves a lot more credit. And some of the things that, you know, not only are the games absolutely free in PDF, but they are dirt cheap in print. I think you can find them at a place called Gateway Games and More.
I've been trying to keep them in stock when I can. But, usually
I don't think he makes a penny off those. I think he like sells them at cost. So
right.
You know, good for him.
Wow. And like I said, I've actually been, you know, I'm glad you told me about it, Rick, because it's actually been what I've been using for my Blackmore campaign. And
I did more than tell you about it. I gave you a copy of it.
No, this is true. This is true.
Like I said, dirt cheap.
So what a small person.
I currently have a 13-year-old in that game. And after trying to tell him a little bit about the history of D&D, he refers to the game as D&D version minus two or negative two. So it's D&D negative two.
With Thaco, you can't blame him for that, right? Like,
there is no Thaco in this.
No, I think he's
making, I'm just saying, armor class is lower, it's better.
Negative two.
Yeah. So in this, it does have the descending armor class. It actually does a good job of walking through how to make the character, and it has an example character. I'm pretty sure you can't find that in the original books.
Yeah.
And it's nice and fast and loose. You know, it's like 140 pages. It's pretty easy to find everything at any given time. You know, the charts are easy to read. James, what font is this?
I was actually looking at that. It looks like the same font as in Moldvay Cook, but I don't.
That's what I'm thinking. It's definitely not the font that was in the original D&D box.
It is definitely a font that is trying to imitate that font, because the font that is in the Moldvay Cook set is a commercial font. So.
So when I look in Basic Fantasy, it looks a little more like Moldvay Cook font. I haven't double checked side by side. This actually looks like it's a larger font size than Basic Fantasy is.
Yeah.
It's at my age, that is not something I'm going to complain about.
No, it's easy to read. I really actually, like you were saying, the art is sparse. I actually kind of, as a reference book, I like it.
Right.
It is very readable. The font is a good choice. You know, the only complaint I have is that it is not serif, and like serifs are nice if you have some reading disabilities, but like it is laid out very well. Two column. So
when I got this, oh, I got to open the magic missile just for you, Rick. Are you ready?
I was going to ask if you didn't bring it up.
This spell conjures a missile, which is equivalent to a magic arrow with a maximum range of 15 inches or 150 feet. The arrow does D6 plus 1 points of damage to any creature hit by it. For every 5 levels of ability the caster has attained, the spell will create 2 additional missiles. So at 6th level, you're casting 3. At 11th level, you're casting 5. A magic missile always hits its target with no saving throw permitted.
Darn tootin'.
So that's actually a bit more potent than first edition AD&D magic missiles.
Yeah. What about original D&D? Is that, they all run together in my
head. So I do believe in the original D&D box, it just counts as a magic arrow doing D6 plus 1. I'm pretty sure you still have to roll it to hit in the original box.
Yeah.
And the Greyhawk, maybe the Greyhawk book updated that.
Yeah.
Interesting that I was just looking because I had to know when you said it always hits. Shield does not mention that it protects you from.
Oh, I guess that came along later then.
Yeah. So.
Oh, I'm looking that up right now. So I thought. So here's a little bit of trivia. I was reading an Ernie Gygax post the other day, and he was talking that they came up that him and his father were watching The Raven with Boris Karloff and Vincent Price, Yeah, the wizard spell duel at the end.
Love it.
is where they got the idea for both the magic missile spell and the shield spell. So shield, so in this edition, it does not say it stops magic missiles, but it does in first edition AD&D. Do you know if it does in the Holmes box?
Not off the top of my head.
Yeah, I don't have a copy handy where I would look, but yeah, that's interesting that it doesn't mention that. So yeah, magic missile's potent.
And, I had to go on YouTube and watch the spell duel, and Boris Karloff seems to throw magic missiles at Vincent Price, and he puts up a little shield that stops them all.
I remember.
Nice. So
anyone who has not watched The Raven needs to go watch The Raven.
Yeah, especially if you're interested in, like, you know, there's so many people that are attempting to, like, read all the appendix in the movies, but books, but yeah, don't forget that there's a movie on that list, and that's definitely a part of the appendix in experience.
So we've been name dropping some movies today. Jason and the Argonauts, Clash of the Titans, The Raven. I mentioned Hercules, so I guess Steve Reeves' Hercules Unbound.
Wow!
Oh, wow!
If you want, I mean, if you want something visual that's not too abysmal.
Yeah. not too abysmal.
Yeah. So I think I've been delighted with this. So I guess that's really about all I have to say about it, unless you guys have any more questions.
Well, I mean, in your role as a game store owner, you've probably sold this to a couple people. Anybody ever, like, come back and say they didn't like it, or, you know?
No, actually, I've had about a half a dozen different people come in and play it, and everyone has been pretty happy with it. It's got a good genuine old school feel, and you know, it's put together and organized very well.
It's great for, like, someone who wants to know more about, like, the early days of the hobby, but doesn't have, like, $1,000 or whatever. You know, you can get that and experience it, and all on the cheap.
Right.
Especially if you're comfortable, like, with PDFs or printing your own, you know, for freaking free.
Right.
But, you know, like I said, it can be found in print very, very cheaply, very, very reasonably. And there's a ton of different, can it use basic fantasy adventures? Or does it need to be, like, its own?
So it's close enough. So I'm using it to run old Judge's Guild adventures. So
you can convert on the fly?
Yeah, well, with the Judge's Guild stuff, you know, I don't have to, because it was pretty much written for OD&D plus whatever supplement was out at the time.
Well, yeah. And I think on Goneman's site, you can find quite a few things that have, like, supplements and adventures that are available for it, all absolutely free. Or you can go to Dragon's Foot and, you know, check out all the adventures that they have, and they have them divided up into, like, original edition, first edition, second edition. So just grab something for the original edition and, you know, go to town.
So, if my campaign goes long enough, and if I ever stop being so stingy with experience points and gold, there are some fairly high level Dave Arneson modules that were put out for BX that I might integrate into the campaign a little bit. So I guess we'll see how that goes in the future. But, That's cool. it's simple, very clean, classic D&D with all of the ambiguities removed, basically.
Well, I didn't give one myself. I forgot because I guess I was running long. But what don't you like about it?
As much as I like the fact that you can get it for free, I would actually really love a nice hardbound copy.
Can't you get it in hardbound?
I will have to look and see.
I was too cheap to get it for you in hardback, but, you know,
I think it is
available.
Maybe a little more artwork would have been nice. But,
we all know, because I was showing it off before the show started, but I took the Mazes and Minotaurs books, the three core books plus the companion, and I have them printed up via Lulu, and I'm very happy with it. So I'm sure if you know, if you can do it with that, you can do it with Iron Falcon and have yourself a little hardback book.
Oh yeah,
it would be nice to have it in digest. That would be my own.
Oh, digest sized.
That I don't know if they do. Oh, you know, but then again, well, I also love the chance to get anything in spiral bound because the way it lies flat on the table. So that's the other thing. I just had a spiral bound book made for myself today on Lulu. So, you know, not a movie, but there's a name dropping websites or web surfaces as well. So.
So James, tell us about your pick for the day.
So my pick for today is something that I came.
Not Fate, is it, James?
Well, Rick, have you tried Fate?
I have, buddy.
So hear me out.
I've got the dice to prove it.
No. So my pick today is something actually I came across through James McGeorge of Aleph Null Press and Adam Miscavige of Metal Gods of Ur-Hadad.
Adam.
So we are running a little low on our name dropping.
Yeah.
Quota for the episode, so that's good.
Okay, that's good. I have some more. I can.
Excellent.
So Adam actually ran this for me, and James McGeorge and a few other Metal Gods alumni, and it is an RPG called Warband by Mike Davison of the Sword Plus One blog from back in the G Plus days. It is also on theme for our podcast, a free PDF that you can find on the internet that we will link. And it has some fantastic artwork as the cover. It is kind of a heavy metal chaos inspired cover by Jeremy Duncan, which is always fantastic. But Warband is...
What else has he done that we might be familiar with?
I knew you were gonna ask that, Rick. You know what? I'll have to look.
That's cool. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
If you see his stuff, you'll recognize it. It's very distinctive style. But Warband is a RPG that imagines what it would be like to take basic Dungeons and Dragons and throw on to it the theme of the 1980s Realms of Chaos, Lost in the Damned, and Slaves to Darkness Warhammer Fantasy supplements. So if you're not familiar with Realms of Chaos was a two-book supplement by Games Workshop back in the 80s. That allowed you to kind of play around with and get background and lore about all of their factions of chaos. And it had a lot of, it wasn't an RPG so much, but it had a lot of tables that you could use in Warhammer Fantasy to kind of sort of use it as an RPG. And it basically, you know, had all kinds of information on how to play, you know, different characters devoted to a specific Warhammer Chaos God. Warband takes that theme and files off all of the Games Workshop intellectual property for obvious reasons, but allows you to play some very similar but wholly distinct for intellectual property purposes characters. So it uses a D&D basic, I would say kind of Moldvay Cook base, but throws in some differences. So it is, just to read the introduction is real fast. The game is a homage to the grim dark, a game of spiky power armor wearing, bolt gun shooting, chainsword waving chaos worshippers. Characters struggle to survive in the warp of space as low-level members of a Chaos Lords warband. They strive to make a name for themselves and eventually capture a ship of their own.
Okay, so this is like, I'm sorry, I must have misunderstood. This is more like 40K than Warhammer Fantasy.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Okay, I got you. I'm with you.
It is a Warhammer 40K-esque base D&D with a D&D basic kind of...
Rail guns, chain swords.
Yep.
Space marine armor, all that jazz.
All that jazz. It's got all of that. So the it messes around a little bit with the basic stats. So you have strength, dexterity, constitution, intelligence, but you also have psychic power and charisma.
Okay.
So the classes that allows you to play is beastmen, so mutated beast folk characters. Marauder.
If you want to play a Skaven, are you basically a beastman with a rat theme?
Yeah, I would. I mean, that would work for.
I guess that was leading into. Do they have like the sacred cows of like Warhammer 40K? As far as like the Skaven, obviously being one of them. Skaven were part of 40K, weren't they? I'm not really.
Early days, in the Rogue Trader days, yes. Nowadays, not so much.
Warhammer Fantasy, then
40K. Yeah. But
I'm sorry, I keep interrupting. Go ahead.
No.
I'm fascinated by that.
Oh, it's a fantastic game. So the other class, so the first one is Beastmen. The second class is Marauders, which is kind of your Chaos Marines.
Oh, yeah.
So they're your heavy armored, weird mutation kind of Marines. There's Ogryn. So just like it says, large ogres. There's Psykers, which is your psychic wizards that wielding dangerous chaotic powers. There's Squats, which is like Chaos Dwarves. And... that is it for the classes. So you're playing some variety of those. It has kind of, as you can imagine, just like the Realms of Chaos, it has a lot of fun tables for figuring out what your random chaos gifts are as a worshiper of chaos. And then it has different mutations you can add to that. And basically, you start out as not just your character, but as a warband of characters. So you have several followers with you. And the game kind of sets you out in some random space hawk that you're crawling around, that's sitting out in the warp somewhere, drifting in space, and kind of sets you into a mega dungeon environment from the get-go. And you crawl through, adding worshipers and progressing in level and acquiring new mutations as you go. It has all of the normal kind of spells that you would expect as well, kind of D&D spells put in there. So fireball, charm person,
magic missile. How does it work?
Magic missile. A missile of magical energy darts forth from the caster's fingertip and strikes its target, dealing 1d6 plus 1 points of damage. The missile strikes unerringly, even if the target is in melee combat or has less than total cover or total concealment. Specific parts of a creature can't be singled out. For every 5 caster levels, the caster gets 2 additional missiles. 3 total at 5th, 5 at 10th, 7th at 15th. If the caster can shoot multiple missiles, they can that can be directed to strike a single creature or several. A single missile can strike only one creature.
So pretty classic.
So it sounds
not straightforward at all.
It sounds along the lines of original D&D.
It does actually.
OD&D. So, what are the ability scores like? Are they the same or close to it?
They are close to it. The ability scores, the only difference is instead of wisdom, they add psychic power. It's 3d6 in order. And let's see. 3 is -3. The ability scores do go quite a bit higher. They go up to 25 plus.
Oh, okay. Nice.
plus. So as you can imagine, like Ogryn and people in power armor are going to have quite high armor class.
So going up to 25 is 18, like the bonus being a plus 3?
I believe so, yeah.
So it's a typical, you know, negative 3 to plus 3 as far as like your 3 to 18 scale. And then, you know, of course, I assume like up to 25, it gets better and better.
Yeah, so 18 to 19 is plus 3, 20 to 22 is plus 4, 23 to 24 is plus 5, 25 plus is plus 6.
Okay.
So,
nice.
Yeah, and because of mutations and stuff like that, obviously you can have augmented strength. There is kind of your standard group of monsters that you would expect from 40K, just with, like I said, intellectual property kind of.
So they resemble, you know, it's just like, you know, kind of like there's a lot of the shades of D&D that have like those IP protected monsters from TS or from Wizards, just under different names. So same thing here.
Same thing. So instead of the elves, you have the Eld. Instead of Tyranids, you have the Insectoids.
Okay.
The Orcs is still the Orcs. So
with a K?
That's good. Yeah.
With a K?
With a K, yeah.
Okay. Yep. So James, I've looked up the cover artist, J.D. Duncan. Mm-hmm. He's the artwork in this book is fabulous. And if you go to DeviantArt, J.D. Duncan has a really nice gallery of art on DeviantArt, some of which I recognize from the Warband book. But just beyond that, he is very, very unique in his art style. And cool. I really like it. So if anyone is out there making a role-playing game right now, they should probably call J.D. Duncan and get him to do some creatures for him.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's fantastic. It has such a, you know, heavy metal 40K vibe to it that I absolutely love.
Speaking of heavy metal, so how many, you know, if this game had been around, well, in a sense it was, in the sense of like the source material, but had it been around like, you know, in the early 80s, early mid 80s, how many heavy metal bands do you think this would have spawned?
Oh, several
bands. All of them?
Yeah, all of them. Most of them. Yeah. It's it just kind of oozes with that whole vibe throughout the book. I love it. So we played 6 months worth of Warband on every Sunday for a while, crawling up and down a Space Hulk that I'm pretty sure Adam ran at from a D&D basic module with all of the things reskinned for 40K. We fought orcs and traded teeth for weapons, and we ended up corrupting some sisters of battle to chaos. We came across Necrons and kind of like the precursors of Necrons. It was a fantastic time, and the whole theme of kind of building this warband with that is following a single chaos god and just kind of constantly cycling in and out, you know, beast men and other followers that you just pick up as you go is a ton of fun. It's a very rules light game, OD&D, D&D basic base, and yeah.
Was it like 44 pages long? Is that
44 pages is all, yeah, all it is. So like it is the bare minimum you need to run. There is on the Sword Plus One blog, there is a kind of a official zine for it that only had like four releases called Boarding Action. So there's Boarding Action number one and some special three other releases that had some weapons and armor and some aliens to add to the game. But we had fantastic fun with this for at least 6 months. I think it might have been longer. It was pandemic years, so I can't really remember how long it took. But
there was like a time vortex. We've been traveling through a time vortex for about 3 years.
Yeah, we drifted through the warp for quite a while. So, you know, who knows? But yeah, we had a lot of fun. The weapons is a lot of fun. It's kind of interesting to play in a OD&D base and then be shooting bolt guns. So right. If that is something that sounds cool, and it is cool, you should check it out.
Well, for comparison's sake, if a magic missile does 1d6 plus 1, how much does a bolt gun do?
So a bolt gun does a base damage of 1d8, but it has 3 shots a round.
Nice.
Wow.
So, yeah. So one of the things you can do is shoot multiple shots in a round in this game, and it is highly effective. Once you get some cover, what we found out very quickly is that melee in this results in death almost immediately. So we very quickly learned to take cover and engage in range combat first before wading in with giant squigs or orcs in melee combat.
Nice. So I'm starting to get the stink face from our producer, our new producer, Leland. You guys have all met Leland, right?
Yeah, he's got quite the stink face.
He does.
I've decided I'm not going to remember their names anymore until they've been around for at least 3 episodes. So,
right.
So
at this rate, you just know, Todd and James.
I do.
Sometimes.
So, real quick, same question I put to Todd. Obviously, you like the game. We all liked our games, but is there anything that you don't like about it?
Yeah, the only thing I don't like about the game, to be honest, is one of the things we found, and I think it was one of the first things that we house ruled, was how difficult it actually was to get a chaos mutation. The chaos mutations is some of the most fun part of the game, is getting new mutations. And it actually is fairly difficult to roll to get one. And so that was one of the first things that we changed, I believe, was we changed how easy it was to get a mutation, because that's part of the fun. So
cool. So I guess we'll go ahead and wrap this up. Hopefully, if everyone likes this episode, every half a dozen episodes or two, we might squeeze in another triple shot of old school fun. And at that, I would just like to give you the words of the good advice dwarf. Never split the party.
Never fire into melee, unless, of course, you're shooting a magic missile.
Always listen and check for squigs.
Sure. So thank you, everyone. Goodbye.
See ya.
Bye.